Welcome to Call For To Connect, the podcast where a call can make all the difference in someone's life. I'm Kim Clyden, and each week we'll explore something beautifully simple but profoundly powerful, picking up the phone and calling four or more people. Four real conversations, four chances to remind someone they matter. This movement was created by Charles and Tracy Alder, who've spent decades supporting Australians through fire, flood, drought, and just as devastating, silence. Because loneliness isn't just a feeling, it's a quiet crisis, chipping away at our mental health, fueling anxiety and depression, making people feel like they don't belong. Left unchecked, it can become life-threatening. Together, we can break the cycle of isolation, remind our friends and loved ones they're seen, valued, and never alone. In each episode, we'll hear stories from people making connection a habit. Community leaders, everyday Aussies, and voices from around the world who are proving that something small can have a massive impact. So let's get into it, because the world doesn't need more noise. It needs more human connection. Our guest today understands what it's like to feel isolated following his highly publicised termination from media in 2022. Making significant lifestyle changes, veteran broadcaster Chris Smith is back and continues to engage people in conversation across the Super Radio Network and 2SM in Sydney. He takes calls from across the nation on topics that affect everyday Australians. But it's the calls he makes to others that really feel good. A patron of the rural charity Horizons Foundation and suicide prevention charity Australian Man Cave, he's here to share his story. Hey Chris, thanks for coming on Call 4 to Connect. When did your broadcasting career start?
It was because of what I was doing at school. I was a big mouth at school, and I got into oratory and public speaking and made a pretty good fist of it and won a few awards, some Sydney Metropolitan Awards, and I knew I was going to talk. I mean, my father was a great current affairs political observer, and so that sort of played a role in where I thought I was going, and I wanted to be in news, talkback radio, all the way from when I was in, like, year nine at school, and that followed. So I went out to the bush and did my apprenticeship, which at the time was the way to go, and then did news as well as host programs and called rugby league as well. So did everything at the country radio stations, and then got back to Sydney where I worked at in the newsroom at Channel 7 as a reporter, and then at a current affair, and then in other places as well. So, yeah, it was one of those things. Rarely do kids sort of know what they're going to do early, but I did know what I wanted to do early, and I just pursued it from the get-go.
What impact has having a public profile had on your life?
I think having a public profile has probably given me more advantages than disadvantages, especially in this job where every day you're fighting for someone's rights, you're trying to do favours to people who are not getting through to agencies or government authorities, and you come up with successful avenues for them. And all of those things, you tend to, you know, receive terrific positive feedback on a regular basis. And they wouldn't be listening to you on your radio station or your television show if they didn't have some degree of respect for you. So it's a positive world, you know. And you get to meet wonderful people. I've met people from Billy Connolly and Billy Crystal and Diane Keaton through to the stars of Australia and every prime minister that have been since I've been alive. So I think overall the public profile is a positive thing. It's when you make mistakes in life, and I've made mistakes, and I've been sort of tailed by the black dog a little bit from when I was about a teenager. And so when you make mistakes, which can be fueled by that lack of esteem for yourself and a mechanism that makes yourself destroy, when you're in the public profile, you hit the ground hard, especially if you're flying relatively high. You know, the newspapers can be very, very cruel and harsh. And so I've gone through periods, probably three periods in my life, where I've had falls, and I've struggled to accept those falls, and the coverage being high profile has only compounded my depression over all of that, you know. So it comes with the good and the bad. It's just how it is, and you've got to accept it either way. You know, I've gone through periods where newspapers have done 8 stories over 8 consecutive days on me. And then, you know, you got murderers who get stories over 3 days. And, you know, you try and reconcile that, and it's hard to reconcile that, but it just goes back to having a high profile. And for some reason, this country, we like to bring down our tall, popular poppies.
Your struggle with your public profile and your job doesn't really mean that you're that person behind the scenes. And so much has changed in the last 45 years. So what impact did that public humiliation have on your personal life?
Oh, well, I spent time in a mental health facility at one stage. I spent time in a rehabilitation facility one time for alcohol abuse. Those periods of my life were deep and dark and horrible and depressing. And, you know, that's just a fact of the matter. When you take a tumble, you fall very fast and hard, and it's just part of what we do.
How many people stuck by you through that?
Oh, stack of people. The people who don't stick by you are ones who actually don't think you're going to amount to much, or you can't reinvent yourself, or you can't come back. So they finish using you. And so I can list, you know, 10 or 15 different people that didn't keep in contact, didn't bother seeing how I was, you know, and I've got a little bit of a list of people who did that. It's not a long list, but, you know, I've since worked out that now that I'm back on 2SM and the Super Radio Network after a couple of 2.5 years, they want to come back into my life. It's funny that. And I've realized, therefore, it's sort of answered some questions about why they left my life in the first place. It wasn't because of what I'd done. It's because I wasn't a help to them anymore, which is just human nature, I guess, for some people. But I had stack of, you know, I wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't for the help that I had when crashing by so many friends, so many colleagues, so many workmates, so many people in the media industry who I didn't know who came to my aid. That incredible wave, tsunami of support, knowing what I'd gone through from people I knew and I didn't know, was what kept me from necking myself or doing something, you know, terrible.
How did you feel through that period? Because it can be quite isolating. And what did those people provide you that was a lifeline?
Yeah, it was about the time and respect that they still had for me buoyed me more than anything. It wasn't what they said. It wasn't what they said might happen down the track. It wasn't the hope that they gave me. It wasn't any of that. It was just them picking up a telephone, sending a text message, or being present and not making me lonely. That was the essence of their connection, you know, and that connection itself was the strength. As I say, it wasn't them saying, oh, you'll be right, you'll be back. I'm confident that you'll get back into the industry. Wasn't any of that. I'd thought I'd never go back into the industry ever, and I was convinced of that. And I also didn't think that I could handle the pain of what I was going through much longer. So I was convinced that things were worse than what they probably were, and that I had no hope, I had no future, I'd lost the respect of my family and all that sort of stuff. But then I just had this tsunami of support, and the mere connection and the time that people spent coming, meeting me, catching up for coffee, catching up for even just a knock at the door, that was what kept me on my feet.
Yeah, so you talked about your family in there. How do you think it sort of affected your wife and your children?
Well, my elder children, who were in their 20s, they were incredibly supportive. As a matter of fact, there was a period of time soon after I had my crash that my daughter basically saved my life. I was about to take my life, and she intervened and got me back out of this deep funk. I was just totally convinced that this is what I had to do to eliminate the pain. It wasn't how I had it all sorted out. You know, it wasn't if I'm going to do it. It was when and how, not if. And so she saved me. So my kids, my eldest kids have been fantastic. My younger kids were a little bit too young. They were 6.5, 7. They were too young to realize what had went on. And my wife was understandably upset that I would, you know, drink for 8 hours at public functions and get myself into strife. And so she was as angry as hell, and she had to get on with making money to pay our mortgage, to look after the kids. And to a certain degree, it hurt our relationship immensely. But, you know, that's part of the process. Things have been repaired dramatically since then. but I guess that relationship will never be the same. You know, it's just how it is. And the struggles that we go through as a family are a little bit more complicated because of what has occurred. You know, I don't think the same about things, but at the same time, it's also given me a great perspective on where family sits. Like in the last 2.5 years, I haven't spent more time with my family ever. The public functions and the attendances at events are non-existent for me. They don't matter to me anymore. I try and get out of every one of them. Spending more time with the kids at the park and spending more time with my family together is what I, you know, walking the dog on a Sunday morning and having breakfast together is my top event of the week. I love it. And so things have changed. You know, that wouldn't have been the case when I was working 3 jobs and working, you know, 20 hours a day.
It's amazing how these experiences provide us with a totally new perspective. What sort of perspective do you have on, you know, keeping in touch with the people who kept in touch with you, and how important is a phone call?
Yeah, well, this is the point. I see a phone call as so much strength for both the phone caller and the person receiving the call. It's so important, which is why I'm very much supportive of this particular campaign. And my strength in just making contact with people, you know, to be able to ring someone, even someone who was supportive in when I was down on my knees and struggling, is so important to me now. And I, you know, there are various people who've been by my side, and I still now have time for them by my side. When in previous eras of my career, I wouldn't have had the time for them. I wouldn't have seen that as the priority. The priority had to be chasing news, gathering talent for those news stories, putting them on air. It was all work, 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 and that was the priority. Whereas now, nowadays, me finding fallow time to make a call to my friends and those that have kept in contact with me is a really pleasurable experience. It's valuable experience. It does me as much good as I know it does them, because, you know, they too have their own challenges in life, and we support each other. And it's the connection. It's not what you say. It's not words of wisdom and all that sort of stuff. It's just the connection where you've actually taken time in a very busy life for them, and vice versa when they do the same to me. It's a wonderful thing. And I've got time for those phone calls, not like in previous eras when I wouldn't have time for more than a 60-second phone call.
That's the whole focus of Call 4 to this initiative we're talking about today. And I'm wondering if it's something, you know, you would actually use, is to schedule those calls as a reminder that, hey, oh, actually, I haven't spoken to this particular person for a while.
Well, it's interesting. When this was put to me, I understood that I was experiencing this. That is, instead of having a 60-second call with someone saying, oh, we're going to catch up sometime, what about Saturday week? I'll try and organise something, but I can't talk now. See you later. That wasn't a catch-up. That wasn't a telephone call that made any of us any wiser or felt better. It just wasn't. But it was the way I would communicate with friends and family when I was very, you know, very busy and focused on work and work only. Whereas now, I actually find time to sit down. So it's whether it's Saturday morning in the sunshine on my back deck, picking up the phone and saying, how the hell are you? How was your week? What the hell were you doing? I do it on purpose to make sure that it extends beyond that 60-second limit. But it's important to do that. It's important to actually ask how they're going, what they experience, and what some of their highlights and lowlights have been. And so the important, it's a little bit like people saying, oh, you've got to say to people, are you okay? Well, I think there's a hole in the argument of asking people, are you okay? Because it's single dimensional, it's short, and it's very easily fobbed off. I'm not criticizing the campaign. I'm just highlighting what I think this campaign offers that the previous campaign doesn't. I just think that to make a connection with someone, it's got to be more than 60 seconds.
Intentional.
Yeah.
I don't know how we've lost those communication and conversation skills, but it seems to be leading to this, what's been coined as a loneliness epidemic. Why do you think, as you know, as society, we've reached this point?
Well, because we've been so technologically focused, which has created more work for ourselves. So therefore, when we look at our email, or when we look at our telephone and the text messages we've got, we have generated ourselves, because of that very fast and efficient technology, more work. We've got responses from people about 6 different things instead of the 1 or 2 things we used to get established before we had technology and devices. So we're creating all this work, And to get through all of this daily work that we've created, we've got to deal with it in a short space of time. That's where we've lost the ability to properly communicate.
So it's an attention span thing, and because we're constantly distracted by so many other things that we've lost sight of focusing on the things that matter.
Yeah, the critical mass has just exploded in terms of our, you know, daily job. I don't know about your diary, but my diary will have 40 different entries in it today for me to do 40 different things. I can't, you know, the days before devices, that was not the case.
Do you find, like me, it also makes time pass quicker because we fill every day with so much stuff?
Yeah, where's our fallow? Where's the part in our diary that says at 2 o'clock we're going to have a fallow half hour where we don't look at our device and we're not necessarily doing a chore or doing work, but this is my layback time or this is my socialization time? Where in the diary do we put that in?
Wherever we feel we need it, this is where self-care becomes so important. I mean, is that something you'd consider now that you're more mindful of this connection?
I think I do this now. Like, I know that I have time. Like, for instance, on Sundays, I won't touch my phone. And it's a deliberate thing where I think I need to be drained of that stimulation. I need to be drained of that focus. And I want to give time to other people, most importantly, my family or friends. And so Sundays, I just get rid of it. But on top of that, I make sure that Saturday morning too, I have time to do my stuff, take the dog for a walk, spend time with my kids just over a coffee and yakking about nothing and just having that fallow time. It's important to have. And that also includes, you know, I could probably pursue doing more jobs at the moment and making more money. Well, unlike the way I used to operate, and that would be the intention, let's fill every part of our living day with work and make as much money as we can to get the best mortgage. All of that's gone. You know, since my more troubled times, I've since realized that it's not about that anymore, you know, and that's got to do with experience and age and you know, probably the appreciation of how long you might have in life. I'm in my 60s, so I'm probably on the back end. And so, well, I know I'm on the back end. And so therefore I want to spend more great time, you know, relaxing time. And so I'm doing that on a regular basis now.
Chris, why did you choose to go back to public life in radio when you had experienced some of the worst types of backlash?
Yeah, I thought it was an impossibility for me to accept being in the public eye again. I felt so intimidated, embarrassed. I felt like I couldn't possibly do it. I also accepted the fact that I couldn't possibly be employed again. But as it turned out, I was, for whatever reason. And so I've been extraordinarily lucky. And this particular job came up, which I've always wanted. That is the morning show and a morning format of talkback. I have always coveted. But I'd sort of come to the realization that that was never going to happen again, that I was never going to be in broadcast again, that I couldn't possibly get in. I couldn't be strong mentally again or strong in my gut to be able to handle the brickbats that would come my way. And so I'd resigned myself to all of this. I said that this wouldn't happen, nor do I want it to happen.
What did you learn out of that experience, though, that you've brought with you into this role?
Oh, that's a big question. I probably learned to be a little less quick to judge. There's certainly a lot of that. I've probably learnt to give a little bit more time to those who I was probably short with. Like, you know, there are certain callers and listeners and followers that ring radio stations that you really get angry with because they babble on about nothing, make no sense, and you very quickly dismiss them. I don't do much of that at all. I don't have callers. You know, I don't cut them off like I used to. Probably have become a little bit fairer. You know, I probably understand what it's like to be crippled by your situation. And so I have a little bit more sympathy for people, I guess. And I've actually spoken about it with my mentors. I've had a stack of mentors helping me through. And we've actually deliberately spoken about what I would be when I got back on air. And these were the things that dawn from those conversations. And so that's certainly the case. And the other thing that I've learned about my work is that if I want to get back into the public eye, I've just got to accept the fact that there are people who will not like me at all. And so when the call comes in after a promo is played and someone rings and says, what's that bastard doing on air ever again? Or I get an email, which, you know, we usually get lots of hate mail anyway in this, even when you're popular. But I get my own hate mail, and they like to bring up previous indiscretions. And I've just got to cop that. I've just got to – if I'm going to do this job in the public eye, one of the things I've got to do is be tougher about copping that kind of – you know, vile criticism, and it can be awfully vile and foul and hideous. And so you just got to be a little bit more resilient. Like, if you're going to take this on with the mistakes that I have made, well, I've got to be prepared to be tougher about how I cop that kind of mass criticism. So, you know, I think I have. I don't think it hurts me as much as anything. You know, the hurt that I went through when I fell was the greatest hurt of my life. Nothing else could come within cooey of it. And so maybe that's helped me be resilient. I guess if something doesn't kill you, you can just be better at handling it, you know?
And a lot of the people who call you are very lonely. I knew that in radio we'd get calls from people, and you knew that there was no other person they'd probably spoken to that day other than you. So does that help you be kinder to them?
Oh, yeah, that's a given. I've always been aware of that. But, you know, I've also come to the realisation that in everyone's life there are tragedies. In everyone's family there are people who upset other members of the family when they don't mean to, but they do, and they sometimes do it regularly. There are relationship breakdowns. There are stupid things done with grog. There are stupid things done with the opposite sex. This is normal life. Now, the degree in which that occurs in each family differs, of course. But, you know, what I've experienced, I don't take it as I am some kind of extraordinarily sick person that has had falls thanks to drinking too much grog. Well, thankfully, I don't drink anymore, so it's not a problem. But I don't beat myself up like I probably thought I would. So that's been helpful to me, and I know that everyone else, and I hear it every day, like even the Mark Latham story. I had Mark on today. He was being interviewed on my show, and I had a pack of calls afterwards from people who were being sympathetic to him. Now, I'm not saying whether they should be sympathetic to him, but they too, you know that in their lives they've had weird experiences, terrible relationships, things that have gone pear-shaped, a conflict of relation of feelings towards the other person, and that has gone absolutely vile. And people ring, and that's part of their life as well. They too have those experiences. It's not just people in the public eye, except the people in the public eye get it covered more extensively.
And they never get to live it down. It can change people's reputations. And Chris, I can say it's been an honour chatting with you today and getting to know the man behind the legend, which, well, that's the way we could look at it. So thank you so much for giving us your time and for talking to me about, one, your experiences, and two, the importance of connection through a call.
Yeah, connection. Thank you very much. It's really important. A proper connection, not a 60-second connection. It's got to be a proper connection, and that's when you get the mutual respect between two people who are making that connection. I see it, I experience it, and it can work for everyone.
Thank you so much, and take care.
Thanks, Kim.
Broadcaster Chris Smith leaving us with a very important message based on a very real experience. To get involved in this movement, go to callfor.life and sign up to set up your call list. You'll receive reminders to call those you care about and help them feel connected and valued. Over the following weeks, we'll speak with people who live remotely, truly isolated, and others who've counselled farmers in rural communities to hear their stories. Thanks for your company. We look forward to you joining us again next week.